listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Frenchy Revolution by Mary Pilon, with illustrations by Christopher Buzzelli. Next illustration shows a black-and-white mottled French bulldog with blue eyes. Some preservationists argue that those who merely own and aren't actively campaigning unofficial colors of Frenchies are guilty of sullying their beloved breed, like Lenarth. The nonprofit FBDCA's website features a no-fad colors logo with a blue dog struck through with a red line. You take your standard as a blueprint, and you try and stay as true to that blueprint as you can, Sosa said. It's not just the physical, it's the health. We require eyes to be certified so there are no eye problems. We want dogs to have a long, healthy life. And this is not just for show dogs, but for pets also. That's where the word preservation comes in. The opposing political camp is that of the inclusive breeders. They believe that colored dogs, as non-brindle, fawn, white dogs are known, including the popular blue, have a place in the French bulldog community. Often these breeders focus also on health testing and fitness, that is, metrics to measure a Frenchie beyond color that didn't exist a century ago when the standards were established. The relationship between color and health is a debate of its own. Critics argue that preservationists are also trying to control supply and demand. When we have systematic exclusions based on color, they will serve to make the breed more exclusive and increase demand, said Cameron T. Whitley, a sociology professor at Western Washington University, who studies how people make decisions tied to animals. And then, of course, there's also infighting because of that situation. The economic engine of the purebred world is a constellation of dog shows, dog care, and breeding. On any given weekend in America, thousands of canines and their support humans pour into fairground lots, high school fields, convention centers, or other venues for AKC-backed dog shows, all part of the year-round circuit toward Westminster. You'll find as much hairspray as you would backstage at a beauty pageant. Women in Sunday church hats and men in suits pushing crates of furry creatures to and fro, and handlers who may earn upwards of five figures on a given weekend trotting canines around makeshift rings. The sidelines are ideal gossip pulpits, as one may be waiting for hours for a few minutes of showtime. The wild tides of subjectivity and judging are a topic of discussion. The only thing missing is Christopher Guest. In lots of cases, these dogs are being treated like an accessory, like a Prada bag, Whitley added, and I think the evidence for that is we have such disregard for the health and well-being of this animal. Even owners who don't care about showing their dogs may be contributing to AKC coffers. Although the AKC bans colored dogs from its competitions, the organization does permit dog owners to register a dog for a fee ranging from $35 to $86.99. The AKC earned $59.4 million in 2021 from dog and litter registration, roughly half of its total $116 million in revenue that year. The AKC does not break out registration revenues earned by breed, according to a spokesperson. Registration is not dependent on participation in dog sports, she said. We are a pedigree registry. A purebred French bulldog, regardless of color, can be registered as long as it is from an AKC litter, and it will be listed on the pedigree. Next illustration shows a dark gray, or blue, French bulldog. Many owners who register their dogs never go to a dog show, but they do want to know the lineage of their dog, which is where registration comes in. Of course, many animal rights organizations, notably People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, object to the existence of dog shows and Frenchies alike, seeing them as an extension of the now-shuttered circus circuit. They argue that purebred dogs like Frenchies feed an industry that diverts resources from the estimated 70 million rescue dogs and cats that need homes, only 10% of which end up in an animal shelter, according to PETA. Flat-faced breeds like Frenchies, they argue, are suffering. If not for humans, French bulldogs would be extinct in a generation, as they generally have to be artificially inseminated and mostly only deliver puppies via cesarean section. Blue Frenchies can be even more rare and difficult to breed. Some countries, including Norway and the Netherlands, are pushing regulations that would curb the breeding of flat-faced dogs, including Frenchies, citing health concerns. As for the color wars, they are absurd. Daphna Nachmanovich, PETA's senior vice president of cruelty investigations, said, and really discriminatory and, frankly, a little bit twisted. These are dogs. Dogs don't know what color they are. It's a bizarre way of categorizing them and making them pieces of meat. We have a global animal welfare crisis, she added. The world needs to wake up. The AKC sees things differently. People are entitled to their opinion and their preferences, said Brandy Hunter-Munden, an AKC spokesperson. For centuries, they have provided more than just companionship. Purebred dogs have assisted humans in hunting, medical care, service, and protection. Their predictability has long been touted among owners as a virtue and desired trait among people who are seeking a dog to fit their lifestyle. Ensuring that owners are educated on how to properly own a dog and what measures should be taken to prevent unplanned or unwanted litters is something that the AKC consistently advocates for, the statement continued. There's a darker human toll. As the monetary value of French bulldogs, including blue dogs, has increased, so has concern about their theft. The highest profile example may be the Gaga incident, which resulted in a 21-year prison sentence for the man who shot the dog walker. But it was not an isolated case. Vanity Fair counted at least 40 incidents in the United States of Frenchie-related violent crime since the Gaga shooting in 2021. Across the country, Frenchies are going missing from porches, yards, and homes, or stolen on the street. The theft of one French bulldog at gunpoint in Orange County, Florida, in 2021 led local law enforcement to a larger dog trafficking ring, where suspects would cut microchips out from under the dog's fur and flesh so the dogs could then be bred or sold for cash. Last year, Pennsylvania's attorney general announced the arrest of 5 people who conspired in a similar scheme to steal puppies. Often from the Amish, then sell the dogs via social media platforms, resulting in a loss of more than $430,000 in dogs. In May, a French bulldog named Pablo was held for ransom in Maplewood, Minnesota. Prosecutors have charged 2 individuals in the matter, and as of September 20th, the case is still active, according to a representative with the Maplewood Police Department. Frenchies have been involved in high-speed chases in Louisiana and Southern California. In the United Kingdom, some crime syndicates have shifted from drugs and cigarettes to dogs, with an estimated 100 dog smuggling gangs operating in the country. Frenchies have money on their paws, said Karen Turquin, a private investigator focused on animal cases since 2005. In the more than 5,200 dog cases she has worked over her career, she said that Frenchies are also some of the hardest to return to their owners. They're an elite dog, she said. Then, all of a sudden, they became popular. And like everything else in the U.S., our culture overdoes it. The climate at dog shows has also raised alarm. In October 2021, a brawl at a bulldog show in Miami went viral. While no one reported serious injuries, a chair and fist flew. Last year, a Georgia teenager's puppy was stolen from his arms at a local dog show. In March, a gun was fired at a French bulldog show in Oxnard, California. The Ventura County Sheriff has still not caught the suspect. And tragically, in February of last year, Lonnie Ray, 76, a South Carolina dog breeder, was fatally shot at a planned meeting to sell a French bulldog in a KFC parking lot. Two men have been charged with the murder. This all began in a different scandal-soaked Gilded Age. Amy Crocker, a railroad heiress known as the Queen of Bohemia, became the first known American celebrity Frenchie owner in 1896 when she acquired Pinko, a brindle from Paris. The snub-nosed companions had by then become accessories to sex workers in the brothels of Montmartre and made their way onto risque postcards and some post-impressionist paintings. Crocker had established her own brand of stardom. She sported tattoos, snakes, an assemblage of lovers. She married five times and proudly strutted Pinko down Fifth Avenue. A year after Pinko's arrival, the FBDCA was established. Crocker had become not just the most famous Frenchie owner, but the breed's greatest advocate. She was among those who campaigned to have Frenchies included at Westminster, which was founded in 1877. When she and her Frenchie coalition members objected to the judges that Westminster had selected, they staged a protest show at the Sun Parlor of the Waldorf Astoria. The New York World published a screed comparing the posh lifestyle of Crocker's Frenchie assemblage with the plight of the city's poor. Nonetheless, by 1899, Westminster had added a French bulldog class to its program. Crocker's dog, Dimbula, took best in class for three consecutive years. Enter Samuel Goldenberg, who may have been the first Frenchie capitalist and a color purist. Goldenberg, a New York lace magnate who spent much of his time in France, realized that a fortune could be made importing trendy new breed. He began selling them for $5,000 to $10,000 apiece at the turn of the century, roughly $150,000 to $300,000 today, according to Heather McPherson, a Frenchie breeder who was working on a book about the dog's history. In addition to breeding and brokering, Goldenberg positioned himself as a powerful judge. Goldenberg used his politics and extreme wealth to change the standard, McPherson said. The owner of a blue dog herself, McPherson said she has experienced harassment both online and in person at Frenchie events, which fueled her interest in researching the origins of color in the breed standard. Goldenberg helped craft a standard that allowed him to control supply and demand, as well as stereotypes about the breed. Blacks and tans, for example, were banned because they were deemed by Goldenberg to be low rent, McPherson said, as they were associated with French sex workers. By entrenching brindles as the exalted and accepted class, Goldenberg stood to make more from breeding them. The craze also afforded Goldenberg the chance to defeat competitors who were showing blues, grays, and browns in the show ring and beating his dogs. Goldenberg's stronghold on the breed worked. As demand for Frenchies swelled at the turn of the century, so too did a spree of dog thefts and poisonings. In October 1900, Westchester County had multiple reports of thefts, poisonings, and untimely and suspicious deaths. Four dogs in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, were found dead later that month. And in December 1900, no fewer than 15 dogs were murdered in Hicksville, New York. Just when the first wave of Frenchie warfare heated up, after Goldenberg changed the standard, and prices and the frenzy for Frenchies continued to soar, he and his wife, Nella, boarded the Titanic in 1912. They were en route to judge at the FBDCA show to be held on April 20th at New York's Waldorf Astoria. At least one French bulldog aboard the Titanic perished. But Goldenberg and his wife survived, rescued by a lifeboat and then by the Carpathia. He is believed to be the only known Titanic passenger to have survived with his luggage. He made it to the dog show and was heralded as a survivor, his notion of Frenchy color standards cemented. Goldenberg died in 1936, but his breed standard has lived on. While revised from time to time by the committee of the FBDCA, it entrenched the idea that color is paramount to competitive French bulldog showing, and it fortified the FBDCA's power in determining those standards. The main theme is there's extreme racism and discrimination, McPherson said, and the attitudes of people where they have transferred the kind of discriminatory behaviors that were once toward people of the wrong color. Around 2008, the FBDCA began its No Fad Colors campaign. That same year, Terry Huntley began breeding French Bulldogs, and he started to compete with them in shows. As a relative newcomer, I was told that I would probably never win, he said. At first, Huntley, who enjoyed the competitive thrill of showing dogs and learning about the breed, didn't think much of the color standard. He's owned and bred blue dogs. But for Huntley, who is black, he grasped that the fissure in the Frenchie community is not the color of the dogs, it's the color of the people. Determined to win titles for his dogs, Huntley said he began to hire handlers who were white and seen as popular with judges to present his dogs in the ring. It's pretty much giving your dog to a person and saying, "Hey, take this dog in for me." He said the same dogs he had shown were now getting ribbons from judges when they competed with a white handler. Just because they're a popular person, and you hope that their popularity rubs off on your dog and you get to win. Sometimes it's not about who you are, it's about who you can pay to champion your dog out. For Sean Thomas, a black dog breeder based in Colorado who works with non-AKC shows, "The color wars surrounding Frenchies is a witch hunt," he said. "It's laughable to me." Thomas said his focus is on health testing and creating show environments that are family friendly. The AKC's demographics are internal only, but the organization emphasizes it does not condone any form of discrimination. "We thoroughly investigate any reports of alleged discrimination that we receive. We cannot investigate instances of alleged discrimination that are not reported to our organization. AKC clubs have the responsibility of handling reports of alleged discrimination that are reported to them at their events." The FBDCA did not respond to questions about discrimination at dog shows. In 2020, Huntley started his own registry, the Innovative Canine Breeders Registry. "With me being the underdog," Huntley explained, "I said to myself, why not open up a platform for someone like me, or anybody that can come into the ring and win honestly?" The registry, which declares no drama or negativity tolerated, now has 17,000 members and runs 60 shows annually. Huntley describes a landscape of French bulldog breeding run amok, with exotic breeders peddling dogs that may be groomed without health in mind. To him, color is irrelevant. "The problem," Huntley said, "is that preservationists jump to lump anyone with a blue dog or anyone who is different into that category. As a black man at elite shows," he said, "you're an automatic target as an exotic French bulldog breeder because of the color of your skin." Others have seen the color wars manifest in what they describe as pregnancy discrimination. As a veteran who served with the Army's 82nd Airborne and is now licensed to fly helicopters, Amanda Roberts wasn't one to shy away from a challenge. Yet she said that she was surprised to find veterinarians refusing to schedule a C-section for her French bulldog Claire, for the pup sired by her dog Dirty Martini. Dirty Martini had made waves in the French bulldog world when videos of him working out on a treadmill surfaced, Part of what Robert says is her commitment to breeding for health over color. Roberts said she called 5 veterinarians in her home state of Washington before finally getting one who agreed to take her. She said that she was turned away because Dirty Martini is a lilac pied. At least one would only take her under the emergency fee, which is more than double the standard rate. The vets told her, "We don't participate in the reproduction of colored dogs," Roberts said. "We won't accept you." She added, "Honestly, it made me very sad because I was bullied as a kid. My dad was Native American. We didn't go to the right church, stuff like that. I felt helpless and powerless. I ended up leaving the rescue dog world, and now it's happening again because of the color. I'm 40 now and handling it better." On July 11, 2023, Claire had a C-section and delivered a female puppy named Olive. "I definitely feel that they're holding on to that tradition," Robert said, of the preservationist. "I could be completely wrong. I hate to say that because everyone wants the world to be fair." What does fairness look like in a sport, and yes, enthusiasts insist it is one, that is built on subjectivity? Many are looking to be the goat for guidance. Greatest of all time. That's Winston, a fawn-colored Frenchie co-owned and co-bred by Perry Payson. On a recent Saturday morning in Santa Barbara, California, Winston rested under a cooling blanket next to a carefully positioned fan. The 4-year-old Oklahoman claimed top honors at the 2022 National Dog Show, a first for the breed. The win marked his 78th best in show, making Winston the number one ranked all-breed canine in America. "He was like Secretariat," said Payson, whose co-owners include NFL player Morgan Fox. Payson has bred French Bulldogs since 1987, but with Winston, now he and the dog are flanked by fans when they enter arenas. Most competition folds in Winston's presence, merely hoping for runner-up. Winston did indeed finish near the top for his breed at the Santa Barbara show. Although Winston is a textbook fawn, Payson takes a more inclusive view. He promotes health testing over color through the Orthopedic Foundation for Animals Canine Health Information Center. In a bold move, he made Winston's OFA testing public, revealing that Winston's hips are imperfect, a level of transparency that previously had not permeated the upper crust of the sport. Winston has a rigorous exercise regimen, both at home in Oklahoma and when they're on the road. "You gotta be a responsible breeder," Payson said. "It's frustrating," he said, shaking his head as he fed Winston dog treats. Winston seems to exist above the color battle, a Dolly Parton figure who unites the left, the right, and everyone in between. Part of Payson's crusade is also to make all dogs, including rarefied champions, more accessible beyond the show ring. When Payson flies with Winston, he makes a point of letting passengers pet him and take selfies. He recently took Winston on a tour of the U.S. Capitol to lobby for legislation that would provide funding for veterans to have emotional support dogs, including mutts. "Then that becomes a best friend to that person," Payson said. "And you know what that does to somebody? It's huge." For preservationist leaders in the breed, the fight to exclude blue Frenchies from competition has been a concerted campaign, online and in official communications to members. "It is very important that we as member exhibitors in conformation become more proactive," Becky Smith, the FBDCA president at the time, wrote on the group's Facebook page and in a letter to members on May 27, 2019. "We must report DQ colors at show venues. We are seeing an infiltration of DQ color French bulldogs. This is nothing new. However, slick tactics are taking place from color breeders." The letter also encouraged people to write their complaint to the FBDCA Judges Education Committee, and if you can get a photo, do so. The FBDCA Code of Ethics states that its standard is the only standard by which French Bulldogs shall be judged, and that members will not breed any French Bulldog whose owner is directly involved with any purposefully bred non-standard color breeder. Smith posted that she believed disqualified dogs are tough to monitor, but we must, and suggested that in a private group on the Frenchie Talk Facebook page, individual names of kennels should be shared if it is known that breeders are putting titles on dogs that are then bred to disqualified colors. Others call this the blacklist. You have many walks of people that don't want to breed to a standard. Sosa with the FBDCA said, people can do what they want. We choose within the club to breed the way we do, and they might choose whether they like the different colors or coats. That's fine. We don't try to convert them. They don't try to convert us. And that's how I look at it. On a Saturday summer morning, cars, dog strollers, and crates congregated in the parking lot of North High School in Torrance, California. Roughly 1,000 dogs had shown up for the South Bay Kennel Club show, 44 of them Frenchies, the largest group competing. Among them was Jezebel. Charlotte Lenarth and her husband Dean had risen at 4 a.m. to make the trek from their home in Riverside County. Jezebel rested in a canvas wagon underneath a cooling jacket, waiting for the judge to call her number. Lenarth has avoided showing as much in Northern California since Woofstock. For now, she continues to compete with Jezebel in dog shows as far away as Ohio and Puerto Rico, determined not to let the color controversy dampen her joy. She says she has had a lawyer send a cease and desist order to the harassers at Woofstock and has made her social media private. A colleague suggested wearing Google Glass to competitions, but for now, she's holding off. It could either be a shooting or a bunch of old ladies knitting, Lenarth says. You never know. late bloomer. 30 years ago, after David Letterman decamped to CBS, NBC made an historic decision to give Late Night to a nobody, an oral history of Conan O'Brien's tumultuous and hilarious first year by Andrew Buss, with opening illustration by Mike Toffanelli. The illustration shows David Letterman, Sarah Silverman, Robert Smigel, Lisa Kudrow, Max Weinberg, Bob Odenkirk, Janine Garofalo, Lorne Michaels, Andy Richter, and Conan O'Brien on set at the show. If you tuned in to NBC at 12:35 a.m. on September 13, 1993, you witnessed late-night history in the making. Jay Leno had inherited The Tonight Show from Johnny Carson in 1992, and a deeply pissed-off David Letterman had decamped to CBS. That meant a new host for Late Night had to be found. NBC turned to Lorne Michaels, who tapped 30-year-old Conan O'Brien. When NBC announced the identity of the man who would take over their decade-old franchise, TV critics, audiences, and even Letterman himself had the same question. Who? O'Brien, now regarded as one of the best hosts in the medium, one who spent nearly 30 years on the air, had minimal on-camera experience when he landed the job. As he once quipped to a journalist who called him a relative unknown, "Sir, I am a complete unknown." To be fair, O'Brien had already been one of the era's sharpest comedy writers, working on Not Necessarily the News, Saturday Night Live, and The Simpsons, not to mention spending 2 years as the president of the Harvard Lampoon. Those who witnessed his high-energy pitches in writers' rooms were already aware of how brilliant he was. Now, everybody in every living room in America just had to agree. NBC suggested that Letterman not be mentioned in the inaugural episode on September 13th. But O'Brien knew that was absurd. He, his head writer, Robert Smigel, and his team found the perfect way to address this head-on. The cold opening found O'Brien walking down the street cheerily, as everyone he encountered greeted him with a similar refrain, "You better be as good as Letterman." Then O'Brien retreated to his dressing room, and while whistling, prepared a noose to hang himself before a crew member informed him that it was time to go on. That's how Conan O'Brien introduced himself to the world. The opening let audiences know what they were in for. Silliness with splashes of intellectualism and edginess, plus a final coating of self-deprecation. It was a far cry from Letterman's beautifully constructed sardonic style or Leno's more traditional desk jockeying. It was a new show for a new generation. To mark the show's 30th anniversary, Vanity Fair spoke to O'Brien and many of those in his orbit about that wild first year. Lorne Michaels, executive producer, Late Night with Conan O'Brien. "There was a group of us who wanted Letterman to host The Tonight Show instead of Leno. David decided to go to CBS. And I got a call from NBC President Bob Wright, who said that they were going to announce that I was producing the new late-night show." David Letterman, host, Late Night with David Letterman. "I remember in that overlap transitional period, there was so much attention to the change. Is he going to stay? Is he going to leave? In the beginning, it was kind of exciting. And then I soon sickened of the attention because I was unaccustomed to it. It really began to be superficial. And I felt my ego had been set on fire, and I can't possibly stand it anymore." Michaels, "Everyone who had been in Late Night was a baby boomer. I think it was, who do we know in the 28 to 35 group? We looked at a bunch of people, and I talked to Conan about being the head writer on it." Robert Smigel, head writer, Conan O'Brien. "Conan joined Lorne in the pursuit of finding the right host. He went out to dinner with various people. The more he did, the more he thought, 'These guys are great, but I kind of think I could do it.'" Lisa Kudrow, close friend of O'Brien's and early guest, Conan O'Brien. "Conan was spending time looking for who the host would be. He knew he wanted to do a show that was not just celebrity interviews, but hosted by someone who knew enough and who read enough to ask intelligent questions of scientists or authors or other people, too. And I said, "So it sounds like you want you." And he said, "That would never happen." O'Brien had been thinking about what he wanted to do next in his career. The logical next step was shifting from writing to performing. He told Michaels he was bowing out of the head writer role, and the network brass at the time continued to search for a host without him. Michaels, producer Jeff Ross, president of NBC's West Coast division Don Ohlmeyer, president of NBC Entertainment Warren Littlefield, and executive vice president of late night and special programming Rick Ludwin, headed for the Hollywood Improv one night in April to scout talent. They didn't see anyone they were ecstatic about. The next day, they met in Ohlmeyer's office. Jeff Ross, producer, Conan O'Brien. Lorne brings up Conan's name and says, "Well, Conan maybe could host it." And the NBC guys were going, "You think?" I remember Lorne turned to me, not knowing that I had ever met Conan, and goes, "You think?" And I go, "Maybe." Then NBC said, "Can we test him?" Lorne turns to me and says, "Jeff, can we test him?" And I was like, "Sure." Michaels, "The more that I spent time with him, the more I started to see it. I thought he had the intelligence. In a small room, he was truly funny and fast. So I thought more and more that he could do that." Conan O'Brien, host, "There isn't another person in show business who could have said, 'I have an idea. He's a writer on The Simpsons, but he's got a good look, and I bet in time he'd be a good host.' No other effing person in show business could have said that." Smigel, "I was excited for him, but I was scared. I remember saying to him, 'Man, that is a tough way to get on TV.' I wasn't the best person to rev him up in that way. As much as I wanted him to make it, I just reacted honestly. But he said, 'If I get this, I really want you to be the head writer.'" With short notice, O'Brien's team managed to get Mimi Rogers and Jason Alexander as guests for his audition, and he won the crowd over when he told Rogers, "People always say that it's tough to be a model. Turning a big crank is tough." The joke helped get O'Brien's support within NBC. O'Brien, "The audition was fun because I had nothing to lose. The minute I got out there and there was an audience and I got to sit behind the desk, I loved it. It felt very much like linguine meeting marinara sauce for the first time." Smigel, "After that, my confidence went completely in the other direction, like, 'He's going to be enormous. I can't believe how big our show is going to be.'" O'Brien, "You could say I had more confidence in that audition than I had in the actual show for the first year." Even though O'Brien had impressed NBC, they were still thinking about going with Gary Shandling instead. O'Brien, "Lorne Michaels called me and said, 'You're not going to get it. It's going to go to Gary Shandling. Shandley's going to do 12:30. I hung up, and I remember saying to Lisa Kudrow what I just heard, and I said, "Yeah, I don't see it. Gary's a peer of Dave's." And at the time, he was doing the Larry Sanders Show. He's getting all this critical praise for making this amazing show that satirizes the form. I don't see him going in and doing Monday through Friday. Kudrow, "I don't know how much we talked about it. I just knew. You're trying to replace David Letterman. No one replaces David Letterman. You are no one." And here she laughs. "It can't be anybody that an audience would know." Sure enough, Shandling was out. The show went to the underdog. O'Brien, "It is a moment that is seared in my memory. It's the day of a recording of a Simpsons episode. We're all sitting around a table when someone in the room said, 'Conan, there's a phone call for you.' And I went up and got on the phone, and it was my agent at the time, Gavin Pallone. And in a quiet, calm voice, he said, 'You've got 12:30. Ross, "I went out to lunch, and my assistant handed me all my messages, and it's like Rick Ludwin, Lorne Michaels. The names made me look at this and go, 'Oh, my God, he got it.'" Letterman, "I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know what he sounded like. I didn't know anything about him. So my reaction to Conan behind that desk was similar to everyone's reaction, which was, 'Now, who is this? Why is this guy here? Who will be the real host? Immediately after giving him the job, NBC had O'Brien rush to Burbank to appear on that night's episode of The Tonight Show so Leno could introduce him to America. The next task became figuring out what on earth the show would actually be like. O'Brien, we didn't have much time. I get selected in April, and I don't really get to start working on the show until late May. Smigel, we idolized Letterman, which affected a lot of my approach. I was desperate to do anything Letterman didn't do. O'Brien, first there was Carson. Then there comes for our generation Letterman, who is ironic. Then we thought, okay, what comes after that? It needs to be more cartoony. The performances can't be a wink and a nod. This has to be a new thing. This has to be postmodern. And I think what we ended up with was it's got to have elements of SCTV and Pee-wee's Playhouse. We had all of these very strong, almost religious beliefs about what this needed to be. Smigel, I said, do we have to call it late night? Can it just be a brand new show so it doesn't feel like we're stepping into Letterman's shoes? O'Brien, if it was late night with David Letterman and then we called it something else, maybe that would help lessen any comparisons between me and Dave. Smigel, I suggested Nighty Night. Conan liked that a lot because it felt appropriately silly for his personality. And then, oddly enough, Lorne Michaels came to us and had the same notion that we should change the name of the show. His idea was calling it Night Night, which I thought was better than Nighty Night because it wasn't silly in an alienating way. O'Brien, I remember us going and pitching this idea to Rick Ludwin. We say to him, okay, we don't call it late night because we'll be compared to Letterman. We call it Nighty Night or Night Night with Conan O'Brien. And then he just cut us off and went, well, let me tell you something. Late Night has been a very lucrative franchise for us. It has existed for 11 and a half years under David Letterman. We have three franchises. The Tonight Show, which began in 1955 and has had multiple hosts. We could see that happening with this franchise, Late Night. And there's no way in God's green earth that you are changing our franchise. In addition to Smigel, producer Jeff Ross became an integral part of the team. O'Brien, Jeff Ross is just a perfect producer for me. He's really good at making it happen. Jeff's heart beats once every 9 minutes. He works at that temperature that really helps work with me and offset my madness. By early summer, they started filling out the writers' staff with what now looks like a who's who of comedy. Smigel, Bob Odenkirk, Andy Richter, Dino Stamatopoulos, Louis C.K., Marsh McCall, Michael Gordon, Amir Gullin, and David Reynolds. Andy Richter, sidekick and writer, Conan O'Brien. I got a call from Robert saying, would you like to meet with Conan and maybe see about getting a job as a writer on the show? And I said, sure. O'Brien, Andy and I met at a diner. He sits down opposite me, and I had ordered already, and the waitress said, what do you want? And he said, I'll have a bowl of borscht. It was really hot outside, and he ordered a big bowl of beet soup. Richter, we just hit it off. It's a real joy when you meet a person who just wants to be silly and is into having fun. The people that I love the most in this business are people where that's their first priority. Like, yeah, we'll do a show, and it will be good and everything, but first and foremost, we gotta have fun. O'Brien, I called Robert and I said, let's hire him. Robert said, well, he hasn't submitted a packet yet, and I remember wanting to hire him without him even having submitted a packet as a writer. Dino Stamatopoulos, writer, Conan O'Brien. I submitted a bunch of comedy bits to Conan. I said, I don't really want to work on this show, but I just want him to have those comedy bits without me being on the staff or anything like that. And then they hired me anyway. Smigel, Dino wrote the best packet that I've ever seen anyone write. He was a no-brainer, which says a lot, because I love to agonize over every decision in my life. But Dino was the easiest hire we made. Dino, I remember seeing Louis C.K.'s packet and getting really excited by it. Louis came in for an interview, and I started congratulating him on getting the job way before he got the job. And he's like, don't do this, I'm just going to be disappointed. I'm like, no, you effing got the job. Bob Odenkirk, writer, Conan O'Brien. I think Smigel trusted me to care about the show and maybe know Conan a little bit. More than a new writer would know him. I came to New York, and I was here for 3 weeks in the early days. I saw some of the first test shows. Then I went back to L.A., and I would fax my ideas in. O'Brien, I look at the snapshot of the very first writing staff, and now it looks ridiculous because we look like a barbershop quartet that would perform at Dwight Eisenhower's inaugural. It's super white and male. I think it's important not just to let it rest with those were the times. Yeah, those were the times. But times change because people make them change. And you just have to be honest and say at that moment that wasn't top of mind. It's a missed opportunity, and that's our loss. I was glad we were able to evolve. But do I wish we had led the way? Yeah, that would have been awesome. Richter was lured into the sidekick role in fairly short order. Richter, Robert said, hey, could you just go down and sit next to him for a rehearsal? Just keep him company. Then as we get closer, he said, would you like to be the sidekick on the show? I said, well, aren't we going to have, like, lots of different opportunities to be sketch players? He said, yeah. I was kind of hesitant. I said, I don't know. Maybe I just want to be one of the other performers and not be sort of nailed down to being myself. And he said, okay, well, think about it. And he left my office, and the second he was gone, I was like, who am I kidding? O'Brien, it was so life-saving to have this funny person who I loved sitting next to me. I needed someone to play off of, and Andy is one of the funniest guys I've ever met. We're so different in certain ways. I run hot, he runs cool, I'm a hummingbird, and he's sort of more stoic. Another highly visible member of the team, drummer Max Weinberg, joined the show after running into O'Brien in Manhattan. Max Weinberg, band leader Conan O'Brien, my wife and I are walking south on 7th Avenue and standing at the corner waiting for the light to turn, holding a paper bag in one hand was Conan O'Brien. O'Brien, I'm walking to a drugstore and I bump into this guy who looks like he works for H&R Block with his wife. And it's Max Weinberg. Weinberg, I said, hey, Conan, Max Weinberg from the E Street Band. Congratulations on the show. We start talking on the corner. He doesn't cross the street. So I said, by the way, what are you doing for a band? He looked at me and said, well, we've got some ideas. And then he said to me, which is classic Conan, do you have any ideas? I ask, what are you looking for? And he starts to describe, we want something that's very versatile. Kind of cartoony, a little Warner Brothers, something different. And I said, I've got just the idea. O'Brien, he said, I could be your band leader. I thought, is he insane? Does he think he's going to get Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band to be my band? And here he laughs. I said, really? You think Bruce would be down for that? No, not Bruce, but I know these other guys. Weinberg, eventually, I had 3 or 4 meetings with them. Music booker Jim Pitt calls me and goes, we had a really great time meeting with you. We'd like to hear the band. Here's where it gets interesting. I never told them I had a band. All I did was tell them I had a great idea for a band. I hung up and I immediately got on the phone with every musician I knew. O'Brien, our band was crucial because they made us look and sound professional. I mean, they showed up and blew the roof off 6A every day. Plus, they could start and stop on a dime. When the show debuted in September, it didn't take long for people to figure out that it wasn't Late Night with David Letterman. The first show featured John Goodman, Drew Barrymore, and Tony Randall. In addition to the cold open, the show had leg wrestling and a Louis C.K. bit called Actual Items that parodied Leno's headlines with comically fake newspaper clippings. It closed with O'Brien and Randall singing Edelweiss as they cut to a nun and a Nazi crying in the audience. The reviews were not particularly kind, save for the New York Times, But the show benefited from the fact that the Chevy Chase show had gone on the air a week earlier and became the fall season's favorite punching bag. Dino, the first episode aired, and we all congratulated each other, like, woo, we did it. Then we went, wait a minute, we have to do one every day for the rest of our lives. Smigel, reviews that pissed me off the most were not reviews that didn't like the show, but ones that said we were ripping off Letterman. And it's like, you don't understand comedy at all. That's the last thing we're doing. Late night shows typically did comedy bits every evening, but more absurd humor drove O'Brien's show, from fake guest to random comedy inserts in the middle of interviews to recurring bits like in the year 2000. One of the most famous segments was done in the style of the 1970s animated series Clutch Cargo and found O'Brien pretending to interview politicians and celebrities while Smigel's lips moved absurdly in a still photograph purporting to be a satellite link. Smigel, I came up with In the Year 2000 for a sketch show in Chicago with O'Brien and Odenkirk in 1988. I thought, we'll make predictions about the future, and the joke will be it's nothing like how we picture the year 2000. Then I had forgotten about it. But when we were putting together the show years later, Conan said, what about that In the Year 2000 a bit? That could work. Me and Andy could do that. And I wanted to have Conan interview celebrities and politicians as a performance piece. Then Dino just randomly in one meeting said, we should figure out a way to do Clutch Cargo bits. And I was like, let's do it with photographs of celebrities and do that instead of having actors come in. O'Brien, I loved how brave those writers were. They were all so young. I think for most all of them, it was their first TV gig. And so the beautiful thing about that late night show is nobody knew what the rules were. Nobody knew what was okay to try, so we tried everything. Ross, Lauren said to me, you guys are going to try to do Saturday Night Live every night, and you can't do it. Smigel, I had sort of a let's F with the old talk show set up, and just have things happen at any time during the show. One of my ideas was that I wanted to have fake guests come on in between two other guests. One week, O'Brien announced economist Woodrow Thomas on Monday night's show. Thomas was bumped Monday, but O'Brien promised that he'd be back very soon. He was then bumped Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. When he finally appeared on Friday, he went off on O'Brien and became hinged. Only thing is, there was no such person as Woodrow Thomas. He was an actor. O'Brien, in order to appreciate that joke, you'd need to watch all five nights. You have to be watching at 1:35 when we wrap up the show. This was a conceptual sketch that was meant for two people in America, and we didn't care. And here he laughs. Smigel, I can only remember one thing that Lauren said. You're not doing that again. We did a character called Funny Joe. It was like a tribute to vaudeville. He would just keep singing, I'm going to make you laugh, and then just do more and more degrading shit to himself. Like take a bunch of eggs and crack them in his crotch. O'Brien, I have sense memories, probably like PTSD. Like, I remember being in a hot tub with David Faustino from Married with Children. Now, why was I in a hot tub with David Faustino from Married with Children? And here he laughs. I'm just thinking about anyone tuning in to any of this and being justifiably confused about what's happening. Jim Pitt, music booker Conan O'Brien, William F. Buckley was in the middle of an interview, and Dino came out doing a bit called Skull Juice, where he was a vendor at a stadium. And a sign said, Skull Juice, 10 cents. Conan said, oh, Skull Juice, I'll have one. And the whole bit is that he squeezes his head and contorts his face and white juice comes out of his mouth. Richter, it was all pretty magical that I got to work in that building on a nightly comedy show for 7 years is really the pinnacle of some version of what I set out to do. Smigel, it was the most exciting job I've ever had. It's so fun to remember. O'Brien, The story of how I end up as the host of that show and then what we do with it is highly improbable. You can draw it. You can diagram it. It just seems kind of crazy. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.